content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the November 7th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we see Donald Trump. He's riding a wrecking ball. He's holding the chain with his left hand. With his right hand, he's giving a thumbs up. His hair is blowing in the breeze and his ties flying back behind him. In the background, you can see part of the White House standing, and right in front of him, it's just complete demolition, which I assume is the East Wing. And the headline is Ballroom Blitz, Why Trump's Demolition of the East Wing Sparked So Much Outrage. We pick that up in the controversy of the week. Start with the first main story. Shutdown threatens food benefits for millions. What happened? Pain from the government shutdown spread across the country this week as food benefits were set to halt for more than 40 million Americans. Shortages of air traffic controllers caused flight delays to spike, and some 65,000 young children faced losing access to education, meals, and health care through the Head Start program. Things are getting real, said House Speaker Mike Johnson, as hardship grew for unpaid federal workers amid the now month-old shutdown. Their largest union called on Congress to pass a clean funding bill, something Democrats have refused to do without an extension of enhanced subsidies for the 24 million Americans who get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Federal workers standing in line for food banks after missing a second paycheck deserve better than partisan gamesmanship, said Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees. Senator Raphael Warnock, the Democrat from Georgia, said any bill that takes health care away from millions of Americans could not be considered clean. Some 42 million Americans were poised to lose food assistance on November 1st as funding ended for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The Agriculture Department, which administers SNAP, said it would not use emergency funds to cover benefits nor reimburse states that temporarily cover them. Senator Josh Hawley, the Republican from Missouri, drew 10 GOP co-sponsors for a bill to fund SNAP, but Senate Majority Leader John Thune rejected the piecemeal approach to dulling the shutdown's impact. Without a reprieve, we are going to get the greatest hunger crisis since the Great Depression, said Joel Berg of the nonprofit Hunger Free America. As open enrollment started for ACA plans, many Americans saw sharp increases in their 2026 premiums because of the expiration of enhanced COVID-era subsidies for people earning more than four times the poverty level, about $64,000 for a single person. Shortages of air traffic controllers, who are increasingly calling in sick as they work without pay, contributed to more than 8,600 delays on a single Sunday and temporarily halted flights to Los Angeles' main airport. Still, there was no meaningful movement toward ending the shutdown. Both sides think they are winning, said Senator Tom Tillis, the Republican from North Carolina, and that's not fertile ground for any kind of change. What the columnist said. Without SNAP benefits, hunger looms for millions, said Kevin Rector in the Los Angeles Times. One in eight Americans relies on SNAP, and a disproportionate number are children, people with disabilities, or elderly. Among them is Michaela Thompson, an unemployed mother whose toddler needs specialized baby formula because of a feeding disorder. At $47 for a five-day supply, it's out of her reach without SNAP. It feels like the world is crumbling right now, she said. I'm terrified. She should blame Democrats, said the New York Post in an editorial. Helping the disadvantaged used to be a core Democratic value, but the party's only aim now is to oppose President Trump by any means necessary. And if poor constituents suffer, so be it. Even the top federal workers union, a longtime Democratic ally, is demanding Dems pass a clean continuing resolution, exactly what Republicans have offered from the start. It's the GOP that's playing Hunger Games, said Paul Krugman in his Substack newsletter. SNAP has $5 billion in contingency funds that can be tapped in an emergency, and the loss of crucial food aid for 40 million clearly counts. But Trump has directed the USDA not to use it, believing SNAP's loss will mostly hurt urban non-whites and other Democrats. If he looked at the data, he'd see the program is also vital to many of his supporters in overwhelmingly white rural counties. Take Kentucky's Owsley County, where 96% of residents are white. 88% voted for Trump last year, and 37% received SNAP. Johnson had a shutdown strategy, said Paul Kane in the Washington Post. Count on voters blaming Democrats and wait for party moderates to crumble. But Democrats dug in, and a new Reuters poll shows that 50% of voters blame Republicans for the shutdown, and only 43% blame Democrats. His plan has failed, but Johnson, who's had the House on hiatus since the shutdown started, hasn't shifted it. It's the latest in a series of moves that have diminished the role of Congress and shrunk the speakership, said Annie Carney in the New York Times. Johnson has made himself less a governing partner to Trump than an underling, giving the president free rein on everything from spending to war powers. Meanwhile, Trump is nowhere to be seen, said Toulouse Olorunipa in the Atlantic. A whirlwind of action on matters from demolishing the East Wing to prosecuting his enemies hasn't gone to Capitol Hill to jumpstart negotiations, held a White House summit, or addressed Americans on the shutdown. As the impact spreads, he may confront the reality that when a crisis hits, the public often turns to the president for leadership or for blame. While some Americans feel the shutdown's bite, most are barely aware it's happening, said David M. Drucker in Bloomberg, and both sides have incentives to keep the disruption rolling. Democrats want voters to feel the burn of spiking ACA premiums and to please a resistance-hungry base. Republicans are determined not to retreat and confident that, as in previous shutdowns, the instigating party will be blamed. Some hope the promise of shutdown-related pain would force a compromise, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark. Their hope was misplaced. That pain is arriving with a vengeance, and the biggest question is how long it will last. What next? As Affordable Care Act enrollees get letters outlining their 2026 rates, many are experiencing sticker shock, said Anna Wild Matthews and a Sabrina Sakiti in the Wall Street Journal. Premiums are set to spike 26% on average, according to KFF, but the lost federal subsidies could cause the premiums of many households to more than double. Clint and Cindy Cottrell, retirees in Pendleton, Oregon, were stunned to learn that their ACA plan will now cost about $2,500 a month instead of $305. With chronic conditions that require regular care, he has muscular dystrophy. She needs injections for crippling nerve pain. They are considering moving overseas where care might be cheaper. As Republicans grapple with voter frustration over rocketing cost, they face a problem, said Joey Capoletti and Ali Swenson in the Associated Press. While they roundly blast Obamacare as a disaster, they offer no fix or alternative. With no clear Republican plan emerging, the issue appears to be gaining political strength heading into next year's midterm. Controversy of the week. Trump. Why he demolished the East Wing. For a decade, President Donald Trump has bulldozed through the norms that govern the presidency, said Laura Barone Lopez in MSNBC.com. That metaphor turned literal last week when excavators, at Trump's direction, tore down the east wing of the White House to make way for his planned 90,000-square-foot ballroom. Like so many of Trump's actions, the demolition is both of dubious legality — he ignored the standard approval process — and this week fired all six members of the Commission of Fine Arts, which has been due to review the project, and contradicts his own prior promises, in this case not to interfere with the East Wing's structure. The Trumpiness doesn't stop there, said Matt Ford in the New Republic. The project's $350 million price tag is being covered by the usual cabal of corporate and private donors, who can all now expect favors from Trump's corrupt administration. And what does America get for this reckless desecration of our property and norms? A vulgar, gilded behemoth of a ballroom that dwarfs the White House itself and resembles the gaudy golden spaces occupied by preening dictatorships around the world. Of all the reasons to criticize President Trump, this must count as the silliest, said National Review in an editorial. The White House complex has been in a constant state of change and renovation since its completion in 1800. If our republic survived James Monroe's construction of the South Portico in 1824, say, or Harry Truman's addition of a balcony to it in 1948, why does it imply incipient fascism that Trump is replacing a handful of 1940s-era office buildings with a badly needed event space? It has long been absurd that the leader of a superpower has to host state dinners inside temporary tents on the lawn with propane heaters and porta-potties, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Trump's willingness to just do something and jumpstart construction, bypassing the bureaucratic sclerosis that has made it so hard to build anything in America, is a large part of why voters find him attractive. The outrage is about more than that. The loss of a few tons of masonry and mortar, said Adam Gopnik in the New Yorker. Those earlier and far more modest White House alterations were made incrementally and only after much deliberation. Process and procedure are essential to the rule of law and equality, which is precisely why Trump tore down the East Wing. He clearly relishes this act of destruction as proof of his power to do what he wants, when he wants, heedless of law or public will. The latest polls show only 25% of voters support his ballroom project, including 55% of Republicans. Perhaps the visceral shock of seeing the People's House reduced to rubble is waking Americans up to how much else of our democracy is being demolished before our eyes. The next Democratic president must tear down Trump's monstrosity brick by brick, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. To leave the ballroom standing would be to leave unchallenged his vision of the president as king. It could be a while before we see a Democratic president, said Nick Cottagio in The Dispatch. Alongside everything else this project represents, it's yet more evidence that Trump hopes to stay in the White House. In public, Trump has gone back and forth on whether he'll run for an unconstitutional third term. To believe he won't, though, requires taking seriously the idea that he's going to all this trouble, so President Gavin Newsom has a nice spot to entertain visiting dignitaries. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for machine learning. After Kohler launched Dakota, a $599 camera that mounts to a toilet bowl rim, analyzes users' excretions, and sends data on gut health and hydration status to their smartphone. Kohler noted that Dakota's sensors see down into your toilet and nowhere else. It was a good week for rationalization after Representative James Comer, GOP chair of the House Oversight Committee, said he's unconcerned that Trump family crypto schemes lifted the income of the Trump Organization from $51 million in 2024 to $864 million in 2025. The difference between the Trumps and the Bidens, say Comer, is the Trumps are admitting they're doing this. It's a good week for self-acceptance. After reports that many Hollywood actresses are having their breast implants removed. Powering the explant trend, said Westland Professor Victoria Pitts Taylor, is recognition that breast enhancements are passé and not compatible with detoxifying lifestyles. But it was a bad week for empathy after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told ABC's This Week that he feels the pain of America's farmers hit hard by China's boycott of U.S. soybeans because I'm actually a soybean farmer. Bessent, who is worth some $600 million, owns soybean and corn farmland in North Dakota, valued at between $5 million and $25 million. It was a bad week for Melania Trump. After President Trump, addressing U.S. troops in Japan, confessed that, "I don't like good-looking people. I never liked good-looking people." The current First Lady has a distinguished career in modeling, including photo shoots for GQ and Sports Illustrated. And finally, it was a bad week for speed walkers after Slovakia imposed a speed limit of 6 kilometers per hour on its sidewalks with a 50-euro fine for violations for cyclists, scooter riders, and pedestrians. On social media, Slovaks wondered if they could now be fined for running to catch the bus. Briefing, titled this week, A Most Profitable Presidency. Donald Trump has added $3 billion to his wealth since returning to the White House. How? What does Trump earn as president? He gets a $400,000 annual government salary, which he says he donates to worthy causes. But even if Trump kept the entire paycheck, it would be dwarfed by the billions of dollars flowing to him and his family via the Trump Organization, which operates Trump-branded properties, golf clubs, and other ventures. The Trump Media and Technology Group, which runs his Truth Social media platform and various cryptocurrency ventures. Many of Trump's businesses struggled after he left the White House in 2021, according to the internal Trump Organization document seen by the New York Times. But since returning to the Oval Office, his wealth has skyrocketed, climbing to a record $7.3 billion, up from $4.3 billion just before the 2024 election, according to Forbes. Critics accuse Trump of turning the presidency into a cash cow and of erasing the line between business of the nation and his own private businesses. When it comes to using his public office to amass personal profits, Trump is a unicorn. No one else even comes close, said Fred Wertheimer, a longtime Washington watchdog. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt calls such accusations of profiteering absurd and insists the president is abiding by all conflict of interest laws. Is he abiding those laws? It's murky. But what is clear is that Trump has departed from previous ethical norms. To avoid the appearance of self-dealing, Jimmy Carter famously turned over his Georgia peanut farm to a blind trust before entering the White House. In contrast, Trump, in his first term, entrusted control of his assets to his sons, Donald Jr. and Eric, and vowed that no new deals would be made by his real estate business while he was in office. He found other ways to make money. Just before his 2017 inauguration, the cost of membership at his Mar-a-Lago resort doubled to $200,000. It's now $1 million. Foreign delegations, corporate lobbyists, and others seeking to curry favor with Trump invested in and booked stays at his properties. In the first 3 months of 2018, revenue from room rentals at the Trump International Hotel in Manhattan climbed 13% thanks to bookings by the entourage of Saudi Arabia's crown prince. Officials from foreign governments such as China, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates collectively spent more than $750,000 at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. over his first term. He sold the property after leaving office. "Isn't it rude to come to Trump's city and say, 'I am staying at your competitor,'" one Asian diplomat told the Washington Post. Were those payments legal? They led to lawsuits from the Attorneys General of Maryland and Washington, D.C., and from Independent Watchdog, who accused him of violating a constitutional prohibition on the president receiving gifts from foreign entities. But the cases were deemed moot by the Supreme Court in 2021 because he was no longer president. While campaigning for office in 2024, Trump launched a new company that would make it easier to receive such gifts: crypto trading platform World Liberty Financial. Co-founded with his sons and the family of Steve Witkoff, a real estate developer and now Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, the company pays the Trumps up to 75% of the revenue from the sale of certain coins. The family's stake in the firm is now thought to be worth $5 billion. Did business pick up after the election? Just before Inauguration Day, the Trump family launched two crypto meme coins, $Trump and $Melania. The value of both spiked and then crashed, but it's estimated that the Trumps made $100 million in Trump trading fees in less than 2 weeks. In May, Trump, who once called crypto a scam, invited the top 220 Trump investors to a gala dinner at his golf club in Virginia. The top buyer, with nearly $20 million of Trump, was Chinese-born crypto billionaire Justin Sun, who last year spent $75 million on World Liberty Financial coins. In February, the Securities and Exchange Commission dropped fraud charges against Sun. Meanwhile, Amazon is spending an unprecedented $40 million to license a documentary on Melania Trump. The First Lady is expected to get at least $28 million of the fee. Other family members are also capitalizing on their proximity to power. How are they benefiting? Donald Jr. has co-founded the Executive Branch, a $500,000-a-year private members club in Washington, D.C., where business moguls can mingle with MAGA bigwigs and cabinet members. Its opening event was attended by crypto investors, tech CEOs, and at least half a dozen senior members of the Trump administration. Eric oversees the Trump Organization, and weeks before his father's spring tour of the Middle East, he raced across the region to secure property deals, including a $5.5 billion Trump resort in Qatar, funded by firms connected to the Qatari and Saudi royal families. Trump seemingly acknowledged the importance of Eric to the family firm last month when he was caught on a hot mic at the Gaza ceasefire summit in Egypt, telling Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto, "I'll have Eric call you." What do investors get in return? A direct return is not always obvious, but U.S. policy has bent in ways that benefit Trump business partners. Trump has ordered the Justice Department to pull back on investigations involving crypto, which is often used to hide criminal activity. Last week, Trump pardoned billionaire Changpeng Zhao, who pleaded guilty to enabling money laundering at his crypto exchange, Binance. Zhao's firm has close ties with World Liberty Financial, and in September, Trump signed an executive order promising to defend Qatar, which gifted him a $400 million Boeing 747-8 this spring, from any attack, despite the nation's history of supporting Hamas and other extremist groups. The Trumps, though, are unfazed by corruption accusations. "They're going to hit you no matter what," said Don Jr., "so we're just going to play the game." Moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Reckoning with Gaza's true horror. The death toll of Palestinian civilians in Gaza might be even worse than we think, said Lydia Polgreen. Now that there's a fragile and uncertain ceasefire in Gaza, it's time to assess the true cost of this war. Many Americans have dismissed the death toll of 68,229 provided by Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry, insisting it must be an exaggeration to court international outrage. But this death count is unusually rigorous, requiring names, ages, and easily checked identification numbers. With many Palestinians buried beneath Gaza's moonscape of rubble, experts believe the count may underestimate the true number of dead by about 40%. Searching for ways to downplay this catastrophe, Israel's defenders claim that most of the dead were Hamas fighters. But a survey has found that more than half of those killed were women, children, and the elderly. There are also uncounted indirect deaths from starvation and disease, worsened by Israel's decision to block humanitarian aid and push Gaza into famine. Gazans are destitute and facing an apocalyptic reality of total devastation and unfathomable loss. Their misery tells one story, the people who created it tell another. ISIS's lawless reign of terror. One Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent's knee was on his neck. Another was grinding his back, said George F. Will. George Redis, a U.S. citizen born in California who fought for his country in Iraq, was seized by masked ICE agents as he reported to work as a security officer at an agricultural plant in Ventura, California. The ICE agents shouted frantic commands, dragged him from his car, zip-tied his wrist behind his back, and left him on the ground for 4 hours. He was later strip-searched, had his DNA tested without his consent, and was detained for 3 days without charges or access to a lawyer before being released. When Redes wrote a newspaper article about his kidnapping, ICE claimed he'd been resisting its agents, but a news helicopter's video seems to refute the agency's fabrication. As ISIS make-believe warriors answer the agency's call to defend the homeland, thousands of unarmed people who pose no threat to anyone are being roughed up, thrown to the ground, humiliated, and dragged off to detention every day. Our nation is caught up in a tsunami of sometimes lawless law enforcement, and it should shock the conscience of every American. This column comes from France. Why it's so easy to loot the Louvre. It wasn't just the Louvre that was robbed last week, said Mark Baudriller. It was France. When two burglars climbed into a second-floor gallery at the Louvre and made off with 8 pieces of royal jewelry, including necklaces and tiaras that belonged to Empress Past, they stole the priceless heritage of the French people. How could this happen? How can it be that we, the most heavily taxed people in the world, able to finance a bloated administration of nearly 6 million people, can't properly store and guard our national treasures? The answer is that our government does not value them. We spent 4 times as much on our public broadcasting channels, which are responsible for erasing traditional French culture, than we do on preservation of heritage, including our many castles, public sculptures, and museums. The government has seemed determined to erase the monarchy from the books, especially under President Emmanuel Macron, who's been in power 8 years. The result is that the Louvre has been left underfunded and in disrepair. When the burglars arrived, they found shockingly lax security. A construction ladder was parked right outside, ready for their use, while the security cameras by the jewel rooms were pointed the wrong way. Our royal treasures outlasted Nazi occupation, but they couldn't survive Macron's France. The last word, our feature article. 72 peaks, 31 days. Endurance athlete Kilian Jornet set records climbing mountains and running ultramarathons, said Jack Dolan in the Los Angeles Times. Then he decided to do both at once. Kilian Jornet, one of the world's most accomplished mountaineers, did something this month that left even other elite athletes gasping. He climbed all 72 summits in the contiguous United States that stand over 14,000 feet tall in 31 days. That's like climbing California's Mount Whitney, the nation's tallest mountain outside of Alaska, 2.5 times per day, every day, for a month. But reaching so many summits so quickly was only half the battle. In fact, it was the fun part, a surprisingly rested-looking Jornet said in a Zoom interview from Seattle earlier this month, 3 days after summiting Mount Rainier in knee-deep snow to complete the grueling journey, which he started in early September. The hard part was negotiating the spaces in between. If you're driving, you see the landscape, Jornet explained, but you don't feel it. Okay, how do you feel it? By running the hundreds of miles of remote mountain ridges and biking the thousands of miles of desolate highway that separate the towering summits scattered across Colorado, California, and Washington. In total, Jornet covered 3,198 miles under his own power. He biked 2,568 miles. He ran 629 miles. He climbed 403,638 vertical feet. Tommy Caldwell, arguably the best technical rock climber of his generation, and the first to climb Yosemite's nearly impossible Dawn Wall, followed Jornet's progress on Instagram. When the Spaniard finished, Caldwell posted, "My mind is officially blown." Like many elite climbers, Jornet, 37, slips into a stoic, been-there-done-that voice when describing mountain conditions that would terrify mere mortals. But he broke character, briefly, talking about climbing the summit of Mount Shasta in Northern California. As often happens on that freestanding volcano, a howling gale struck just as Jornet approached the 14,162-foot summit. Shaky video shot by a climbing partner shows Jornet's trekking poles flailing and his feet sliding around on the ice as he struggles and fails to remain upright in what sounds like a hurricane. "It was crazy," he conceded. "Probably the windiest day I have ever had in the mountains." Asked why exactly he puts himself through so much agony, he snapped back into all shucks mode. He sank into his comfy seat, smiled with the confidence of a man who has parried that question 1,000 times, and said, "Why not?" In an age saturated with professional outdoor athletes competing for social media attention and lucrative sponsorships, and in a world where the most iconic summits have been climbed, the biggest waves have been surfed, and the wildest rivers have been run, one fashionable way to stand out is by setting a fastest known time, or FKT. Jornet's jaunt over the and between those 72 summits, which he dubbed States of Elevation and gorgeously documented for his 1.8 million followers on Instagram, was, by all accounts, the fastest known time. It was also the only known time. Apparently, nobody else has tried to link all of those summits together in a single human-powered push. The finale of Jornet's 72 peak feet was a 14,441-foot volcano covered with glaciers, one of the broadest and most visually imposing mountains on the planet. Few people even attempt to climb Mount Rainier this time of year because the weather can be so brutal. Jornet cemented his legacy as one of the all-time greats long before this achievement. Born just outside Barcelona in 1987, he grew up in a ski area in the Pyrenees where his father was a mountain guide. He climbed his first mountain over 10,000 feet when he was five. At 20, he won the first of six titles in the Skyrunner World Series, an international competition consisting of long, high-altitude foot races that test speed and endurance on steep mountainsides. At 26, he set FKTs for climbing Switzerland's Matterhorn and France's Mont Blanc, the tallest mountain in Western Europe. A year later, he broke the speed record climbing the bitterly cold and deadly Denali in Alaska, the tallest mountain in North America. A few years after that, he climbed Mount Everest twice in 1 week without supplemental oxygen. In addition to all of the technical mountaineering, Jornette has been one of the most successful ultramarathoners in history, winning the prestigious Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc, a 100-mile race through the Alps, four times. After years of living in Chamonix, France, a hard-partying resort in the Alps regarded as the mountain sports capital of the world, Jornette and his wife, Emily Forsberg, also a world champion runner and skier, moved to a house by a remote fjord in Norway. It's a quiet place to raise their three young children, grow their own vegetables, and train in the surrounding mountains, some of which have no names. Sometimes when you're climbing Everest or Mont Blanc or Mount Whitney, it's like you're climbing the famous name, Jornette said. As he matures, he prefers climbing mountains simply because they're beautiful. But he still craves big challenges. Last year, he climbed all 82 summits in the Alps, over 4,000 meters, that's 13,123 feet, in 19 days, traveling the 750 miles between them on foot and bicycle. This was, without a doubt, the most challenging thing I've ever done in my life, mentally, physically, and technically, he wrote on social media, but also maybe the most beautiful. That got him thinking even bigger, trying to imagine the most aesthetic line for a similar expedition in the United States. After landing in Denver last month, he went straight to the trailhead for 14,256-foot Long's Peak. But I really felt like crap, he said, blaming a combination of jet lag and the air being so much drier in Colorado than in Norway. For the first week, he wondered if he should just quit. But then, somewhere along the way, his body switched from fighting to adapting, and he settled into a comfortable rhythm. After summiting 56 mountains in Colorado, Jornette hopped on his bike and pedaled 900 miles to California, where 15 more high peaks awaited. At times, the headwind was so brutal he slowed to a maddening crawl, even when going downhill. He'd also lost 10 pounds in the mountains, and at 5'7" and about 130 pounds, his slender frame has nothing to spare. So he spent much of his time on the bike shoveling calories, even spiking his water bottles with generous helpings of olive oil to replace lost fat. His long slog on the bike ended in Lone Pine, a dusty town 4 hours north of Los Angeles, where the eastern Sierra rise 10,000 feet, like a solid granite wall, from the desert floor. Jornette had covered nearly 200 miles that day and faced a 6,000-foot climb to the Cottonwood Lakes trailhead, where he would sleep before starting the toughest part of the whole trip. The next morning, he started running Norman's 13, a baker's dozen of 14,000-foot summits along the Sierra Crest between Lone Pine and Bishop, the most remote and punishing alpine terrain in California. He made astonishing time, cruising over 14,032-foot Mount Langley and 14,505-foot Mount Whitney like they were speed bumps. Things changed when Jornette reached a section called the Palisades Traverse, just up the hill from Big Pine. There, a ridge of jagged granite rises like an upside-down saw's blade over one of the last remaining glaciers in California. There are no hiking trails, just daunting towers of shattered and jumbled rock, where seemingly any misstep can lead to a 1,000-foot fall. Only the most committed mountaineers go there, and they tend to take their time, waiting for good weather and climbing with ropes and harnesses. But when you're on a mission like Jornet's, you don't get to choose your weather, he said. You just start, and then you're committed. You have to take what comes. What came the day he reached the Traverse was a surprising early-season blizzard. It covered the usually reliable grippy granite with about 4 inches of snow and ice. The storm made climbing more complicated, Jornet said, and more miserable. It was cold and I was completely soaked, Jornet said. But with the help of Matt Cornell, a well-known climber from Bishop, he was able to keep going and finish the 100 miles of Norman's 13 in 56 hours, shaving more than 19 hours off the previous record. He only slept once during that span, he said, for about an hour and a half lying in the middle of the trail. After the frigid Palisades traverse, he indulged in a bit of luxury, pizza and a glorious night in a hotel bed in Bishop. The next morning, he hiked 14,252-foot White Mountain and then hopped on a bike for the 500-mile ride to the unexpected ordeal that awaited him on Mount Shasta. Having survived that with no serious damage, he biked through Oregon, finally with a tailwind, and then surmounted Mount Rainier. Jornet wouldn't say what his next project will be, but several times he returned to the idea of climbing without crowds or fanfare. I do these things because I love them, because they bring me joy and happiness, not because I think they're very important. One place he can sit quietly is at home in Norway, looking out the window across the fjord to the nameless snow-capped mountains in the distance. He let his eyes linger on their faces, settling on pretty lines to climb up or ski down. A longer version of this story was first published in the Los Angeles Times. We'll pick up a couple of the health and science pieces today. I think the first one will be of special interest to our listeners. Helping the blind to see again. In a landmark breakthrough, researchers used a wireless retinal implant to partially restore vision to people blinded by a common eye disease. The prosthetic device helped 27 of 32 patients with geographic atrophy, a form of age-related macular degeneration that causes the light-sensing cells at the center of the retina to die off, leaving a black spot in the middle of their field of sight. These patients can't recognize faces, they can't read, they can't drive a car, they can't watch television, study leader Frank Holtz of Germany's University of Bonn tells Scientific American. With the implant, though, patients could read letters, they could read words, and they could function in their daily life. The device works with a small camera mounted on glasses, which converts images into near-infrared signals projected onto a chip in the eye. These signals stimulate the surviving retinal neurons, allowing users to perceive blurry black-and-white images. On average, participants improved by 2 lines on a standard eye chart, and side effects such as retinal tears generally resolved 2 months after surgery. It's not a full cure, and training patients to use the implant and glasses setup can take months. But most patients said the rewards were worth the effort. And study co-author Daniel Palanker of Stanford University says this is only the start. The next version, which offers much higher resolution, has already been shown to work in rats. Dramatic drop in peanut allergies. Peanut allergies, one of the most common and dangerous childhood food allergies, are on the decline, reports USA Today. A new study has found that rates among young children have fallen by 43% since the 2017 release of guidelines recommending that babies be given peanuts at 4 to 6 months. Those guidelines were introduced in wake of the landmark 2015 LEAP, that's Learning Early About Peanut Allergy trial, which showed that early exposure to the nut could reduce allergies by more than 80%. For the new study, researchers looked at health records from about 120,000 children under age 3. They found that peanut allergies affected 0.79% of children between 2012 and 2015, but only 0.45% from 2017 to 2020. Overall, all food allergies declined by 36%. Co-author David Hill from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia cautions that more research is needed to understand how and when families are introducing peanuts and to ensure all parents are aware of the guidelines. But he says the study provides the first strong real-world evidence that the new guidelines are working. Parents should feel reassured that early introduction of peanut and other allergenic foods is both safe and effective in preventing food allergy. How to move stone heads. Anthropologists believe they've solved one of history's great engineering puzzles: how the Rapa Nui people of Eastern Ireland moved their enormous Moai statues, some weighing 130,000 pounds and standing 32 feet tall, across miles of rugged terrain without the wheel. The answer, they say, is that the statues were walked upright with ropes, rocking side to side along specially prepared roads. Using high-resolution 3D models, researchers identified features such as wide D-shaped bases and a forward lean that would have made the statues easier to tip and steer. To test the theory, they built a 10,000-pound replica and found that just 18 people could wiggle it 328 feet in 40 minutes. The concave shape of the island's roads would also have made it easy to stabilize the statues as they were moved. Co-author Carl Lippo, an anthropologist at Binghamton University, says the finding highlights the ingenuity of the Rapa Nui people, who erected about 1,000 of the megaliths between 1400 and 1650. The physics makes sense, he tells PopSci.com. Once you get it moving, it isn't hard at all. And we'll finish out the show as usual on the Talking Points page. Looks like we've got time for two of the articles. Sports betting, ruining games and lives. Something bad was bound to happen, said Nancy Armour in USA Today. Ever since gamblers paid eight players on the Chicago White Sox to throw the 1919 World Series, professional sports leagues have vehemently opposed any involvement of players and leagues in betting on games. But in 2018, the Supreme Court made it legal for states to license sports betting companies. As billions of dollars poured in, professional leagues entered into partnerships with the gambling companies, thinking they could take the profits and leave the seedy underbelly. But two federal indictments unveiled last week rocked the sports world, placing the NBA at the center of a massive betting scandal. One case accuses Miami Heat guard Terry Rozier and former player Damon Jones of allegedly leaking confidential injury information to gamblers so they could bet on the opposing team. A second case accuses Portland Trail Blazers coach Chauncey Billups of enticing people into rigged poker games backed by the mafia. This scandal is just the tip of the iceberg, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Multiple pro and college basketball and baseball players have been accused over the years of altering their performance because of gambling schemes. Sports betting is inherently corrupting, and fans must now wonder whether a player claims an injury or has a lousy game if it's because a shady associate bet against his team. Sports gambling also hurts the millions of Americans who gamble past the point of prudence, said David French in the New York Times. One recent Maryland study found that 20% of sports gamblers engage in disordered gambling with negative impact on their lives. Another 31% are on the edge of losing control. Leagues and society have embraced sports gambling at the cost of widespread addiction, bankruptcy, and despair. Gambling is even ruining sports itself, said June Lee, also in the New York Times. Sports was one of the few places where Americans could still gather around something bigger than ourselves while watching competitions in which effort, honesty, and hope could still decide the outcome. But now the games seem more like background noise as fans obsessively track odds, refresh apps, and bet on whether the next pitch is a strike or next foul shot is made. Pure fandom is fading away as gambling touches everything, leaving leagues hostage to the forces they unleashed. We're all poorer for it, whether we gamble or not. Women undermining American institutions? The right has a new rallying cry, said Kathy Young in the Bulwark. Blame women for everything. In a viral essay for Compact magazine that's caused a sensation on the intellectual right, conservative writer Helen Andrews argues that the great feminization of American institutions poses a potential threat to civilization. Now that women make up a majority of the college-educated workforce, college instructors and law firm associates, Andrews asserts, they're imposing feminine values on key institutions. Empathy over rationality, safety over risk, cohesion over competition. This woke, touchy-feely approach is undermining the bold, swashbuckling masculine spirit that once defined these institutions, making them and the country softer and less effective. Until anti-discrimination laws are repealed, Andrews insists in her grotesquely misogynistic screed, things will only get worse. Like it or not, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post, research demonstrates that men and women truly do differ psychologically. Women tend to privilege emotion and lived experience over abstract rules and goals. But if we simply acknowledge the reality of male-female differences, we can maximize the complementary strengths of both men and women. Andrew saves her most apocalyptic warnings for the courts, said Ivana Greco in the Dispatch. The rule of law, she writes, will not survive the legal profession becoming majority female. Her primary example is how woke universities used Title IX during the Obama administration to conduct one-sided evidence-free trials of male students accused by women of sexual assault. But the impact of women on the judicial system is another story. Research shows that political ideology matters more than gender in how judges rule. A conservative female judge is more likely to be more punitive than a male judge elected as or appointed by a Democrat. Gender differences are real, said Matthew Iglesias in Slow Boring, but only on average, and most of Andrew's claims are wildly overstated. She says, for example, that women bosses are too agreeable and incapable of giving orders. Really? She suggests women have gotten ahead only because of DEI initiatives, but women tend to have superior verbal and interpersonal skills, attributes that are crucial to their success in school and many jobs. So how to defeminize professions in which women excel because of superior ability? Andrews stopped short of saying it because it's so horrifying, but it might require affirmative action for men. And a few of the shorter notes. In 2009, the median household income in the average Democratic congressional district was $3,000 lower than in the average Republican district. By 2023, it was $12,000 higher. In 2010, Democrats represented 81 of the poorest 25% of districts and Republicans 30, as of last year. Republicans held 65 of those districts and Democrats 46. At least 20 detainees have died in Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities so far this year, the highest number in two decades and up from 11 in the whole of 2024. Stated causes of death this year included tuberculosis, respiratory failure, and at least 3 suspected suicides. The About the White House section of whitehouse.gov now includes trollish notes about former Democratic presidents, including a reference to the Bill Clinton scandal involving Monica Lewinsky, the false claim that Barack Obama hosted a Muslim Brotherhood visit, and evidence-free speculation that Joe Biden's son Hunter left a bag of cocaine on the White House grounds. On the poll watch, 25% of Hispanic adults have a somewhat favorable view of President Donald Trump, down 19 points from January. And we'll finish with a quote from George Bernard Shaw, who says, "We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing." And on that note, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.